Well, go ahead and turn to Genesis chapter 35. We're going to continue in our series through the book of Genesis. Now, probably most of you know the story of the tortoise and the hare. But you may not know sort of the real life story of the tortoise and the hare, of two teams that raced to be the first humans to reach the South Pole. And it took place in 1911. And there were, again, two teams. There was a, what I call Team Norway and Team Great Britain. So we had these two teams, and both teams had very different approaches. So Team Great Britain was well-funded. It was a highly publicized endeavor. And they used some of the most modern technology that they had, and for 1911 standards, they had motorized sleds. They used Siberian ponies, because why not, right? They chose to wear some of the more modern clothes. They wore wool and leather, which turned out to be a mistake because it's not very effective in extreme cold. Now, Team Norway, on the other hand, focused on simplicity. So they used the old-fashioned dog sleds. They used the old-fashioned fur clothing. They went on skis, and they weren't even very publicized, so they went without the public knowing much about what they were doing. So Team Norway started on October 19th, 1911, and they went for 15 or 20 miles a day max, so they never went more than that, but even when there was bad weather, they always attempted to go at least 15 miles no matter what. They had these built-in periods of rest, and they reached the South Pole first. So, but even better, not only did they reach the South Pole first, but they made it all back safely. Now, a few days after, about 2 weeks after Team Norway started, Team Great Britain started on November 1st. And on the days when the weather was good, they rushed ahead and went as far as they could. But then on the bad weather days, they stopped. However, they quickly started having problems. The motorized sleds broke down. The poor little Siberian ponies died. They eventually made it to the South Pole, but it took them 2.5 months to get there. Even worse, none of them made it back alive. So one of them died from a fall. Another one ended up just sacrificing himself because he knew he was slowing down the entire team because of frostbite on his feet. And then the final three died of starvation and frostbite when they were trapped in a blizzard just 11 miles away from their supply depot. So we have these two groups. We have sort of the flashy and the fast group, Team Great Britain. And then we have the slower and the more humble group. And the end results were dramatically different. And in the passages, really passages, but in our passage today, we're going to see a very similar situation come out. We're going to see two different types of kings. One type is going to be sort of like the flashy Team Great Britain. And then the other is going to be more similar to the more humble Team Norway. And just like the South Pole race, the two kings that are going to be mentioned are going to have dramatically different results. And then, as I'll show you, it's going to lead us right into the story of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And so let's go ahead and let's take a look at Genesis chapter 35, starting in verse 1. God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there. Make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So last week we saw in chapter 34 this horrible incident that took place. People died. Jacob was afraid for his life of being attacked by the surrounding towns and cities. But all of what happened in chapter 34 was happening because Jacob was not where he was supposed to be. And so God tells him, really again, that it's time to move. It's time to go to the correct place. And so Jacob finally does. Verse 5, we see, and they journeyed, and a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel. So Jacob, in chapter 34, didn't have to be afraid. Why? Because God was with him. And even though they had angered the surrounding towns by what happened, God protected them. And so they then finally make it to Bethel. And starting in verse 9, God appears to Jacob again. And this is the first king that is mentioned. So king number one is a descendant of Jacob. So let me read starting in verse 9. God appeared to Jacob again, and when he came to Paddan Aram, and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. You shall no longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you." So first, God reminds Jacob of the name, of his name being changed to Israel. Now, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. But then he tells Jacob that he should be fruitful and multiply. Why? Well, we saw in verse 11, he says, "A nation, a company of nations, shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body." So kings are going to be coming from Jacob. And this is kings plural, because he's referring to a number of different earthly kings that are going to come from him. But there's really just one king that's above all the others, the ultimate king, and that's Jesus, that's going to come from the line of Jacob. But notice, all of what he's being promised is in the future. This promise was not immediately fulfilled. In fact, it was going to be another 1,800 years before Jesus was born. And so that's the first king. And then in the next chapter, we're going to skip ahead to chapter 36, we get a glimpse of the second type of king. And this is a descendant of Esau. Now, admittedly, chapter 36 is not the most exciting chapter in the Bible. In fact, the entire chapter is a genealogy of Esau. And so it's generation after generation of descendants that are mentioned, all with some very difficult names to pronounce. But then we get to near the end, and we get to a very interesting verse in verse 31. So let me read that one. Verse 31, "These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites." So Edom refers to the descendants of Esau. And not only did kings come from Esau, but the passage there, the verse there, points out that they all came before the Israelite kings. So Esau's kings came faster. But did they last? And the answer is no. So there's not even a kingdom of Edom anymore. They were eventually overtaken by a number of different groups and sort of assimilated into those peoples. So let's pause now for a moment and sort of get our bearings. We've looked at chapter 35 and chapter 36. Chapter 35, Jacob was promised the king, that a king would come from him, ultimately Jesus Christ, the most important king. But then chapter 36, we see the line of Esau had kings first. And these were earthly pagan kings who did not follow God. These kings faded quickly out of existence. And yet, most likely for a while, Esau's kings looked like they were winning. Like the Edomites looked like they were winning. They had the power first. They had the position first. They had the kings first. And in that moment, it looks like Esau's line would lead to something great, but it didn't. It was actually Jacob's line, the slower one, the more humble one, that brought us to Jesus. And so let me ask you, what kind of king are you expecting? So Jacob's line was promised kings, but it would take time. Esau's line had kings that faded away. So there's only one kingdom that lasts. Only one king that's going to fulfill what God promised. And that would come 1,800 years later when the king finally arrived. But the problem is similar to the Norway team, that Jesus didn't come in the way that most people expected. Jesus doesn't ride in on with soldiers behind him or with weapons. He doesn't look powerful or impressive. In fact, he rides in humbly, riding in on a donkey. And that leads us into our passage in Luke 19. And I want to show you from Luke 19 how this promised king from Jacob's line enters the city in a very weird way. So Luke 19 is near the end of Jesus' public ministry. He's preparing to go into Jerusalem. So let me read starting in verse 35. And they brought it to Jesus, it being a colt, a donkey. And throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as they rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. And as he was drawing near, already on his way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began rejoicing and praising God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." So in this passage, we really see this tension between a crowd wanting and expecting an Esau-like king, while Jesus enters more like a Jacob-like king. So the crowds are shouting and cheering him on, but they're shouting and cheering because they think that he is going to be their king. And what they have in mind when they think of king is a deliverer from Roman rule. So at this time, Israel was under the oppression, was part of the Roman Empire. And so the people are ready to be delivered, and they want this king who will come quickly, and they want this flashy king who will deliver them right away. But then Jesus sends a message right away as he's coming in, riding on a donkey. And it's clear that the people don't quite understand what he's doing. Now, normally a king would ride in on one of two animals into a town. Would he either be a horse or a donkey? And riding in on a horse has symbolism behind it of conquest and war. So in ancient times, during the Roman Empire, horses were associated with military power. So there were kings and generals and the conquerors. They would ride in on the horses when they came in to invade or to intimidate or to demonstrate their dominance over that town. And so a horse symbolized speed and strength and war and victory through might. But a donkey's the other one. A donkey represents peace and humility when you ride in on it. So it's the opposite of a horse. So it was a symbol of royalty, but not aggressively coming in. And in the ancient Near East, kings would ride in on donkeys in times of peace to show goodwill towards that town. And so Jesus selected this animal to ride in on very strategically. In fact, he selected it many, many years prior, even before he came to this earth, because we know it's prophesied in the Old Testament. Zechariah 9:9 says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughters of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So all this to say that Jesus, riding in on a donkey, was sending a message that he came to bring peace. Not peace for a nation, but really peace for our souls. And it's this approach that changed the world. Jesus offers peace for each person that turns to him. And so no matter what you have done, you can have peace with God through Jesus Christ. But here's the thing. Looking at passages like Luke 19, it's not just a history lesson. It's a revelation about Jesus that requires a response from each of us. So if Jesus is that kind of king, a humble king, a king who came to bring peace, then how should we live? And what should we do with what we've just read? And so I want to give three takeaways from the couple passages that we've looked at. And I want to show you how we can live differently because of who Jesus is. And here's the first one. Don't give your life to flash. Trust the King who came humbly. So too often, we turn to what I call like an Edomite-like king. To the flashy type. But the ones that have no foundation. And these kingdoms never last. These kings never come through with what they promise. And when we do that, what happens to us is we end up with no foundation that we can hold on to. So we're sort of pushed aside in the waves and blown aside with the wind. After World War II was over and France had a bad time in World War I. France was determined to never be caught unprepared again after World War I. And so in the 1930s, they built what is called the Maginot Line. I may be pronouncing that. I don't speak French. I barely speak Spanish, and I had like 6 years of Spanish, but that's a whole nother. Didn't take any years of French. So this line here was this enormous wall of underground bunkers, artillery stations, tunnels, and fortresses, and it stretched for 280 miles along the border with Germany. So they used millions of tons of concrete and steel, and they spent an enormous amount of money to have this out there. So when World War II began, guess what happened? Did it hold Germany back? Did it keep the people of France safe? No, what Germany did was they just went around the wall, through Belgium, and right into France. And France fell in just 6 weeks. And Esau's kingdom, listen, it looks impressive at first. It looks like that long line of bunkers, but turns out to be pretty ineffective. And too often, our faith is like that. We go for the flashy, for the immediate, for the most impressive. But a life built without Jesus Christ is going to fall. Here's the second takeaway. That we should trust God's promises, even when they take longer than you expected. So Jacob didn't see the kings of his lifetime. But he believed God anyway. And 1,800 years later, Jesus rides into Jerusalem, not just fulfilling a promise to Jacob, but offering peace to the world. You see, God's promises that he gives to us require trust and require patience and obedience. But in the end, waiting on his promises always turn out to be better than the alternative. I think of the California redwood trees that I read that they can get up to 400 feet tall, making them the tallest trees in the world. And what's interesting is that they don't start out growing massive right away. In fact, they only grow a couple of feet a year initially. And during this time, what they're really doing is focusing on building a root system. So their bark slowly grows more resilient. The roots go deeper down and intertwine with other redwoods. And it's through this slow growth that then sets the stage for them to eventually tower high in the air. And as Christians, this is the approach that we should take. Not flashy, not racing, but slow and steady. And this allows God to develop in us and to develop us and allows time for his promises to come out in our life. And in the end, we'll be far better off than if we were just to rush into things. And our last takeaway is that we should follow the King who laid down his crown. So the two choices are really not just between kings, but two different types of kingdoms. So there's the quick fix and the war horse and the instant success. And the other that comes quietly, riding in on a donkey, offering peace. Not by force, but through the cross. So Jesus didn't come to take power. He came to give his life. And that's the king that's worth following. Now, at the end of the American Revolution, George Washington was probably the most powerful man in the nation. And people cheered for him. Congress respected him. Many wanted to crown him king. But he did something very shocking. He resigned. He walked away from absolute power and simply just returned to his farm. And in fact, it's reported that when King George III heard of this, of his enemy, what he had done, he said, if he has done that, he will be the greatest man in the world. You see, Washington recognized that real leadership isn't about grabbing a crown. It's about laying it down. And that's what Jesus did for you and for me. Not riding in on a horse to seize the throne, but riding in on a donkey to carry the cross. And because of that, you and I can have peace with God. And so the question this Palm Sunday is simple. Will you follow the King who grabs the glory? Or will you follow the King who gave his life for yours? The one who promises quick results but can't save you. Or the one who came humbly and died for you and me and then rose victoriously. So I'm going to go ahead and close us in prayer, and then worship team, you can come on up now, and we'll close with one last song after that. Let's pray.